there. God. It was the Corbellinia light source. Forget the acronym, but it was a, you know, back in the early days, it was just a linear type of thing, and now it now apparently goes around. So, okay, I'll go to either one. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, read the whole blurb that's on their website. July 30, visit the National Synchrotron Light Source, where scientists use intense beams of light to see the inner structures of batteries, proteins, space dust, and more. Come find out what it means, your photon microscope. Find out what it means, your photon microscope, and why we are so excited about this incredible machine. That's July 30, next Sunday. August 6th, which is the Sunday after that, explore the relativistic heavy ion collider. Let me drop it. Where particles are smashed together at near light speed to reveal the secrets of the universe, visit our particle collider where physicists study what the universe may have looked like in the first few moments after its birth, after the Big Bang, is what I'm guessing. So so Rick is August 6th, and National Synchrotron Light Source is July 30. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, okay. I'll bring that up again. Yeah, that sounds good. See, the RIP program wasn't in operation at the time. They were still building that, the track. You know, they had no rights and everything, but putting that track, which eventually was going to carry pipe. So that wasn't really open yet, but the light source building was. But we were working in a place that was in operation. And I'm walking through the place. There was nothing but oil all over this equipment, all over it, and it had something to do with keeping the humidity away. But every way you looked, it was like, if it was really aluminum foil out of a, you know, some commercial stuff that they were using. But it was all over the place. But they gave us little tags, you know, and it would pick up, you know, if you got too much radiation, it would show up and you would turn these tags in. I guess you went over the numbers, they wouldn't let you back. But it was quite a place. Back to you, Dick.
Paul, I think I'm through with telling people about Brookhaven Labs, so it's time for you to go on with the rest of the space report, if you've got anything more. WS2N, K2LIW.
Just one topic, Dick. That's had to do with the New Horizons spacecraft. That's the one that went out to Pluto. And, two years ago now, it was when it took pictures of Pluto as it went by on July 4th. But now it's on the way to another Kuiper Belt object. It's about 4 astronomical units past Pluto. And that's going to get there on New Year's Eve, January 2019, so on that particular date. Now, they're looking to investigate this I'll call it an asteroid, but it's not like Kuiper Belt object. They call it a KBO, but it's a big rock, and they think it's about 30 miles in diameter. It has the name 2014 MU, that's Mike Uniform 69. I think 2014 comes from when it was discovered. We drop it. Well, NASA and, you know, all the scientists wanted to get more information about this and know that if any one of these objects passed in front of a star that's out in the background, and you have spectrometers hooked up, figure out maybe what this thing is made of, if it has any kind of an atmosphere. You really find out maybe the exact diameter of this thing as it passes, because it would block out the star for a split second, and depending on how long that star got blocked out, they know the speed of the object in orbit, and they know the star is virtually standing still. they can find out diameter, different things they want to find out. But it's tricky to get to move in front of a star and have telescopes look at it when we drop it. I know they tried about 3 weeks ago or so, and wherever it was looking, it didn't work out. But then there was another star, and they knew down in Argentina would be the right spot, and the Earth would be turned in the right direction at the right time, and Argentina was facing in that direction. They're kind of looking up toward the ecliptic plane where both the spacecraft and this type of object is. And the star was slightly above the ecliptic plane, and that angle was just perfect from Argentina facing out toward Pluto, and that's roughly in that direction. And NASA had a picture of one of the five. They had about five different telescopes that were working on this, and they showed a picture before and after. They showed the star background, and they showed this one star, and it blinked off, and it blinked on. So, and they got results from five different telescopes. So I thought it was pretty cool that you could see this roughly 30 mile diameter thing. That's all the way out, you know, four times the distance from Earth to the Sun past Pluto, you know. And you actually see this thing as moving in orbit. Not that you can see it, but maybe this thing passing in front of a star occultation, they call it. I wonder if you saw that. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Oh, I didn't, Paul, but those occultation experiments, which have been done from time to time by watching planet or a moon pass in front of a star with proper timing and with proper photography, that can give you a lot of information about the size of the object that's in the foreground. And modern day spectrometers, when they're used, when the intermediate object has an atmosphere, you can look at the change in the spectrum you get from that atmosphere as it passes in front of the star. So occultation is a very fancy way of getting some extremely high resolution information about rings around a planet, other moons around a planet, diameter of the planet, whether or not it's got an atmosphere. With proper use of occultation experiments, in other words, when an object passes in front of something else that's giving off light, you can get an awful lot of information if you have the right technique. That's what I think you're describing, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yes, and I'm amazed how they can know in the future exactly where this baby all is going to be in relation to some, they actually called it an unnamed star. And, you know, making that prediction works. I find that pretty incredible. If you go to the NASA site, I think they still have that up. NASA keeps, like, you know, maybe 6 or 7 days of that stuff. You can see that picture of that star, you know, going on and going off. So, one other thing I wanted to talk about was we talk about the future of going to Mars a lot on the net. SpaceX had a plan on sending a spacecraft, a Dragon spacecraft, which would eventually be a crewed version. This is actually a crewed version, as if they had a crew on board. He wanted to send it to Mars and land it on Mars with propulsion, you know, no parachutes, heat shield and propulsion, and just land on four little legs. So that apparently is being thrown out the window. Let me drop it. He's starting to realize it's a lot more complicated than what he thought, the way he planned on doing this. By the way, it was supposed to be 2018, and then, I don't know, about 6 months or eight months ago, they changed it to 2020, and now it looks like they're canceling the project altogether, sending this spacecraft to Mars. Or if he does it, it would have to be done in a different fashion. But to come down and have this propulsion system slowing it down as it gets, you know, from orbit, you know, right down to ground on on Mars and then have these four little legs pop out right out of the, you know, to actually land on it and cushion the blow of the spacecraft. He says that it won't work, the weight is too much, which also means that his dream of, eventually sending astronauts into space, which should maybe will happen by the end of next year, 2018, the earliest National Space Station. He planned on eventually, not right away, in the beginning, the initial plans were to send it back with a heat shield parachute and land in the Pacific Ocean the way the Dragon cargo vessels do it right now. But thought eventually he could take the same craft, the same Dragon craft, and do what he's doing on Mars. You know, just deorbit with a heat shield, come down with propulsive engines built into the spacecraft, you know, slow itself all the way down to the ground, and then have four little legs pop out. Again, this whole leg thing, he says, is a lot more complicated than he thought. So that's pretty much been canceled. He says he's got some other ideas. He's going to release that information in September. So we'll have to wait and see what the next plans are. But, you know, he's got a lot of plans. I think I sent you an email. It's a lot of things that he wants to do, and NASA, too. They make these plans, long-term plans, and as the years go by, they change them. Sometimes they eventually do it, but it could be many years down the road. For instance, he wants to send two people in a spacecraft around the moon. You know, Elon Musk has got a grand idea, and I haven't heard anything in about 6 months on that topic. These two billionaire people that were ready to put up money to take a flight around the moon. Maybe he'll do it, but it might be years from now. Original plan was 2018. I don't think he's going to make it. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Just like there are a significant number of people that want to be able to say, even though there's a huge risk to life and probably damage to the brain when you climb Mount Everest, even with oxygen assist, and if you try to do it without oxygen assist, definitely going to be burning up some gray matter in your head in the process. Well, I'm picking number 25,000 feet. I think they call it the death zone, where you're killing brain cells. So there are people who want to be able to say, I climbed Mount Everest. But if you consider the risk and the damage, it's not an extremely reasonable goal. So a person who says, I want to be able to say that I flew in a spacecraft and I circled the moon for some number of times and then came back to Earth, or I landed on the moon and came back to Earth, can't stay on the moon very long. We've already discussed that one. A couple of days at maximum. So all the astronauts on Apollo 11 through 17 were able to do. Let me drop this. And those who think that they're going to mine something that's valuable on the moon and bring it back to Earth, I don't think you can make that economically viable. So some of these missions to Mars and Moon and in orbit around the Moon, or to build a colony in space that's circling the Earth, other than the International Space Station, these are extremely expensive, lofty goals, a not very well defined end product. And some of these goals, you have to be funded by multiple nations, and some of those nations are going to say, if I give you 10 or 20 or 30% of my gross national project, gross national product for this project, what do I get in return? Once they ask those questions, the answers are not easy to come by, in my opinion. WS2N, K2RIW, maybe you've got a more positive spin on it than I do, Paul.
No, it takes money and determination. Governments are able to do so much, but then different politicians get in and they want a different, everybody wants to do something different. They'll cancel projects, start up new projects. Some of them survive, some of them don't. The billionaires have the capability of going forward without, you know, consulting anybody. For instance, SpaceX has no They're not on the stock market, so they don't have a big board to contend with. He does whatever he wants to do. So, you know, that's a plus. But, it's, you know, he still needs billions of dollars to do this stuff. The other guy, Jeff Bezos, for Blue Origin, same thing. It's self-funded. But, you know, it's not that easy. You need a lot of good people and a lot of people. But then moving forward, both companies are doing good. Orbital ATK, now that is on a stock market. Let me drop it. But they have big plans as well. Always been very active. They're the ones that build the solid booster rockets for the shuttle and for the new SLS system. They're shooting the Antares rocket up, Cygnus cargo spacecraft on top. So they're doing good, and they have long-term plans of sending heavy lifting vehicles up too from Cape Canaveral. You know, there's two launch facilities in Cape Canaveral. There's Launch Complex 39A and 39B. 39A is now turned over to Elon Musk with SpaceX. Been launching rockets from there, you know, for the last 6 months. And eventually, by the end of the year, he expects to launch the Falcon Heavy. That's like three Falcon 9 bolted together. Expects to get that off the ground from Launch Complex 39A. Now, 39B, that's the one that NASA's still using. They're rebuilding that thing to launch the SLS system, the Space Launch System. And that's eventually your next rocket to bring people to the moon, maybe, or to Mars, you know, now. But they're in the process of building that. The first test flight will probably be 2019 of the Space Launch System. But even when that's active, Space Launch Complex 39B will be kind of like inactive for roughly every year. They'll probably have one flight per year. Now, Orbital ATK, same company that launches the Atlas rockets and Cygnus from Wallops Island in Virginia, they now got involved with NASA, and they've signed up taking over the same launch complex that the SLS is going to go off on Launch Complex 39B when the Space Launch System is not being ready for a flight. They're going to use it for a massive rocket. They call it the NGL, Next Launch Generation. No, the NLG, the Next Launch Generation. Yeah, I believe that's it. Another massive solid booster rocket type of system, which they plan on sending cargo up. Large satellites and planetary flights in the future. Yeah, they have plans for that, and then way down the road, in fact, they plan on launching people on this thing. So many companies are involved with this, but they all make these predictions flying by, and they make their milestones and some of the goals, but we haven't had people leave from American soil to go to space. It's what, August? No, wait, it was July. July of 2011. A lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of effort, but eventually they'll get it done, I think. So that's my optimistic point. It will get done. Back to you there.
Right now on the International Space Station, how many human beings are there? And in the very near future, what is the average number that they want to keep? Are they attempting to keep five or six people there, essentially 12 months out of the year, Paul? OU, K2RIW?
Yeah, for many years in the beginning, it was three people. And then the goal was to have permanently six people, which they finally achieved quite a few years ago. And that's what they've been doing. The ultimate goal was to have seven. So, now what happened about 2 years ago, Russia was supposed to eventually launch another big module to the space station attached to the Russian side, called the MLM, Multi-Logistics Module. Well, you know, Apache never got off the ground, had a lot of problems. But when that went up, that was supposed to go up, they felt we'll be able to retain our at least three people up at a time. But because that module has had some earthly problems and delays, a lot of delays, they decided to go back down to two people. So the last flight that went up actually only had two people on the drummer. To go to the space station. And, you know, now it's just, and then, you know, a group of three came down. So you have just right now three people on board the space station. And now, it's a complicated story, I can tell you, but to make a long story short, NASA has managed to gain this missing seat that the Russians are going to have for the next 3 or 4 years. They said, okay, we've found a way to pay for this. So now they're back to three. So just for this time, for this last year, at one point they had five people, now it's three. And now, as of the 28th of this month, there's another expedition going up. One Russian, he'll be a pilot. Then you have a European Space Agency, Pablo Nespoli. He's been around like forever. Been up there before. He's 60 years old, 6-0, so he's no kid. And he's from the European Space Agency, originally from Italy. And then the American counterpart is a fellow from NASA. His name is Randy Bresnik. Actually, he's been involved with SpaceX now. NASA chose him to help SpaceX design a crew spacecraft. But I guess he's taking a break from that. They're putting him on the Russian Soyuz at the end of a few days from now, July 28th. And now they'll have six people back on the space station. Eventually, they're going to have seven. Let me drop it. They really want seven, and that will probably start 2019. They'll start testing the Dragon spacecraft at the end of the year with probably two people, and they'll put it in a permanent operation probably sometime in 2019. At that point, they'll be able to send up from American soil four people at a time to the space station. So this way, you know, you always have to have a seat in case there's an emergency on the space station, so these vehicles stay attached for, you know, months at a time, 3, 4, 5, 6 months at a time. I think the Dragon's going to be good for 245 days. So they'll be able to have seven people permanently on board the space station within a year or so. Let's see, probably end of 2019.
It sounds to me like they've got a whole series of experiments ready to go, so they want that many people on board in order to keep all those experiments running full speed, is my guess, Paul. And I'm amazed that they've got that many experiments to keep 6, 7, 8 people running at least 8 hours a day, probably 5 or 6 days per week, month after month, week after week, month after month. I'm amazed they've got that many experiments. I guess some of these are rather long-range experiments, like growing plants in space. I suspect that one of the great plans is to have a self-sustaining system where the plants produce both food and oxygen and take up the carbon dioxide. It would be nice to be able to do that. But to have enough area, I mean,
time, the amount of experiments that are going on the space station are up to 400. You know, I mean, there's some that are static, they're just sitting there like a growing experiment. But then there's others that are very active. They're doing DNA and all kinds of experiments. There's up to 400 experiments. So what you have is, and mostly on the American, European space agency side, the Russians, they were starting to cut back. That's why they thought, well, what do we need all these Russians up there for? So they were just going to send a pilot up, and that was going to be it. You know, and he'll bring the Americans up if we want what a European space agency on the soil is spacecraft. But because they're module, and it's a big module, probably, 30 feet long, 14 feet in diameter, it was attached to the space station. It was going to have all kinds of science experiments on board that the Russians wanted to do. It was going to have another bathroom, sleeping quarters, a lot of stuff. Well, let me drop it. In fact, they just figured that we just don't need it, but the American side and the European Space Agency side, they have more experiments than they know what to do with. So they thought you need some amount of hours that have to go to maintaining the space station. Things break, you have to do an EVA, change batteries out, hook up this solar cell valves, do a lot of maintenance on the facility inside. Filters have to be cleaned. So, all your time can't be dedicated to, eating, sleeping, and experiments. But, they got a hold on it now where, a certain amount of hours can be done for experiments. But whatever those hours are, they can double it by having a seventh person up there because they're maintaining it. They're doing good right now. So that means all that seventh person's hours could be dedicated to experiments. So experimental time will double with seven people. That's what they said back to there.
Okay, so they've got the experiments lined up. So if they can get the people on board, got a rough guess as to what is the financing of the International Space Station for the United States per year. I vaguely remember that NASA's complete budget is something like $18 billion, and some percentage of that is dedicated to the International Space Station each year. Is that a rough guess, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to guess. I remember this a couple years ago. I think it was $4 billion per year for the space station. You're right. It's 18. Well, they got an increase 2 years ago. They were up to $19 billion, and then they just lost only $150 million this time around. I don't know what happened there, but so you call it $19 billion. But they have so many other things that they're doing. They're involved with aviation. They're involved with a lot of stuff. Where they have to put their money up, all these space projects. So it only goes so far, I guess. And, of course, the Russians, they spend money on this stuff, and the European Space Agency, I don't know how many billions of dollars they're spending on it. But the whole cost of of putting that space station up there is $100 billion collectively, between Japan and Russia and us, 19 other countries that were involved. $100 billion. Back to that.
Nice round number, but that $100 billion, that's total. But it's spread over, what's the total number of years from the beginning of planning, constructing, launching, and assembling the space station, International Space Station? Are we roughly 20 years into it, Paul? And if that's so, $100 billion, 20 years is $5 billion per year on average, spread over a whole bunch of countries. So how far off am I when saying that from the very beginning the project was 20 years worth? Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's a good question. Let's see, Ronald Reagan, the one that wanted this thing originally, he called it, I was going to call it the Space Station Freedom. and that kind of went out the window. And then Shepard, he was not Alan Shepard, but Bill Shepard. He was the first commander on the ISS. That's when they will, you know, it was only a couple of modules. We're flying two people at one time, eventually three, and three turned into six. But he wanted to call it Alpha. He was, called the space station Alpha. Now it's just the ISS. So try to think back, Reagan, what year was he in office? Probably the middle of his office, probably the end of the first 4 years. What year was that? That's probably when it all started. Space Station wanted to get all those modular stands in a row. Each one is a room. Let me drop it. You know, they were going to have another one running parallel to it, and then an interconnecting node, you know, connecting them. But, you know, instead of one long module of 10, roughly 10 things in a row, you were going to have two of them. So you would have had like 20 modules. So whatever the initial design was, you know, they cut the cost back in half by doing that. So, yeah. So I'm sure it's probably 30 years. But, you know, even back then, I'm sure they weren't putting, you know, $5 million a year into it. I'm not sure, you know, how they broke the money up over the years. But collectively, $100 billion.
I'm not positive, but my memory tells me that Reagan was elected, we voted on him in 1980, so I think he took office in 81. So 81 to 85 was his first term, then 5 to 89. So 81 to 89 sounds like the Reagan years, and somewhere in the middle of there is when the planning first started and the funding first started for the International Space Station. Is that a good guess, Paul? Over to you, K2LIW.
Yeah, that would make sense. And then designing it was way behind. So they had an interim idea. They decided to send five space shuttles to dock with the Mir space station, the Russian Mir space station. There were five dockings with that thing. And that was in the 1990s. First parts of the International Space Station didn't get launched until, what, 1999. We sent up a shuttle. In that shuttle, we had the Node 1, and then we had two docking adapters attached to it. We had pressure mating adapter number one, pressure mating adapter number two, and all in that cargo bag. And when that was sent up, it released it. I believe the shuttle came back, and autonomously, this whole setup that released the two adapters plus the node in the middle docked with the Russians sent up on a proton rocket the Zarya module, which was a large module that had all kinds of equipment, batteries, and we dropped it. Yeah, they called it the Zarya, but with a Z. And in those days, they were called the Functioning Cargo Block, FGB. That was sent up by the Russians, and that thing docked with pressure mating adapter number one. And it's been like that ever since. Soon after that, they sent up a crew with Bill Shepard, and he had a partner, a Russian partner, on one of the shuttle missions. And they were the first ones to stay overnight. That was probably year 2000. So we've had permanent occupancy on the International Space Station for, I guess, 17 years now, over 17 years. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
So manned occupation from 2000 to 2017, 17 years worth, but the first piece of hardware launched roughly 1999. So 18 years. International Space Station has been in space. So therefore, if I include planning and construction, the project is a lot more than 20 years old. I think it's closer to 25 or so years old, or maybe 26, 27 years old. So the $100 billion is spread over a considerable longer number of years. Very similar to the Hubble Space Telescope. I mean, the total price of Hubble was a lot bigger than the original estimation. But spread over a lot of years, a lot of repairs, we've got our money's worth out of that one. That arguably is one of the most productive pieces of hardware that NASA has ever produced. If the James Webb Space Telescope, the infrared space telescope, let me drop, to be launched at the end of, near the end of 2018, if it does half as much observing as Hubble, guarantee they'll consider that a success. In the case of Hubble, when it originally was launched, I don't know what the number is, but like many of these launches, they probably declared that if it worked for four solid years, it would be a success. Here we are with Hubble. Let's see, I think it was launched originally in, I think, 1991. So we're 91, 2001, we're 25 years into, 25, 26 years into Hubble, way beyond its original predicted life. Has anyone estimated a predicted life for James Webb, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, if you bring up NASA or even Wikipedia, they'll tell you 10 years. That's a 10-year, they're hoping for 10 years. Hubble was, 1990? I think it went up in 1990. It was supposed to go up before that, but because of Challenger and disaster with that, put a lot of things way behind. So it's been a long time since Hubble's been up there, but they probably got more science out of that than anything else. Now with James Webb, you know, it's a continuation. They have other ones that they want to do too after James Webb. You know, there's no end to this. I read there's one telescope that they want to send up with even in meters, and I converted it. I think it came out to 54 feet in diameter. They want to put it in inside of a fairing that's not even built yet. An 8 meter diameter fairing. Right now, the biggest they use is I think 5.2 meters in diameter fairing on top of a rocket. This one would be 8 meters in diameter and 54 feet in diameter. This is what I'm saying about all these proposals. See, you know, it's not 10 cents to, you know, dedicated for these missions yet. And, you know, sometimes you waste a lot of brain cells trying to memorize all this stuff and then it never happens. K2RIWWS1.
The James Webb Infrared Space Telescope, which is going to be launched at Lagrange Point number 2, I think it is, the one that's a million miles away from the Earth, on the other side from the sun, in that particular Lagrange point orbit, it'll always be behind the Earth. The Earth will be a shield between it and the sun most of the time. However, in order to get full performance out of that, the detector has to be cryogenically cooled. I am guessing that implies liquid helium is being used for the cooling. Now, the liquid helium cooling sounds like a consumable material. That therefore, the full performance of James Webb is going to have a finite life before you run out of that cooling fuel, unless it's got a Stirling engine refrigerator-like thing to do the cooling, a closed cycle. So is James Webb a closed cycle cooler, or is that a helium cooler that's going to run out of fuel eventually, Paul? That's question number one, and I think you know where I'm going next. We can dream about a repair mission out there, a repair robot. WS2N, K2RIW.
WH2RIY, what question? Just like what you asked. Hey, no, Joe. And I would say, I remember it's got some kind of regenerative system, Thompson system, but another reason they can keep going like that. And it's not going to be, the Earth isn't really going to be shading this thing. You know, it's got 500,000 miles. Halo orbit, that's quite it, depending on this tennis size mylar shield, sun shield that's going to be set behind it. On one side of the shield is going to be, you know, like 400 degrees, and the other side is going to be, I think degrees Kelvin or something, and then they're going to bring it down to 7 degrees with this regenerative refrigeration system, you know, right near the detector. Be able to see that good in infrared, something like that.
Yeah, I think they call it a Joule-Thompson cooling cycle. Now, that's an electromechanical device, a rotary compressor does that cooling, and that would suggest it might have a finite life. Have they said any words along those lines? Answer that first and then turn it over to Joe. You've got us to call WS2N, K2IW.
You mean it's losing a refrigerant as time goes on? I don't know. 10 years, it can't be. I know they've had 5-year missions, infrared, that have, eventually they lose all the helium that they bring up. 10 years, I would imagine it's got to be regenerative. Maybe not. Yeah, Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, I guarantee it's regenerative, and I don't think it has to lose. When I say finite life, any rotary machine, you eventually wear out a bearing or a piston or whatever. Okay, so it's regenerative, and it's not a sacrificial thing where you're using up helium to keep it cool. To be K2LYY, K2LYW, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you a question. On something that's shielded from the sun, either using the Earth itself from direct sunlight, or even something that's on the shadow of something, what is the temperature in space at a distance of like 1 million miles away from the Earth?
If I understand correctly what Paul just told us, that tennis court sized heat shield, a whole bunch of sheets of mylar, a piece of mylar like material, are the size of a tennis court, and there's 5 of them stacked together. It looks like they're half a foot apart each. And the one that's facing toward the sun will be running at something like 400 degrees. Each one of the 5 runs cooler and cooler. By the time you get to the 5th one, that's always aimed, the whole spacecraft is aimed such that the 5th one is exactly the opposite side of Earth and Sun. That one, I think Paul said, is going to be around 12 degrees, 15, some number like that. And by way of the refrigeration system, they bring it down cooler. The background temperature of space is 3 degrees Kelvin, 2.73 to be exact. That's what the background cosmic ray observatory and all these other, and the Wilkinson anti-saturation probe, all of these spacecraft measure the background space temperature. Let me drop it. If you're far enough away from Earth and the sun is not shining on you, you're looking into that black sky of 3 degrees Kelvin. So if your insulation was good enough on the telescope side, that's on the far side of these 5 heat shields, in theory you could run close to 3 degrees Kelvin. A beautiful temperature to run an infrared telescope. And this thing has got something like an 18-foot diameter mirror. You imagine when they do a ultra-deep field infrared measurement with the James Webb, what they're going to see. Let's see if if it made some sense to you, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW.
21 feet, by the way, Dick.
Fantastic. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, so from what I understand, looking outward away from the sun, it's 3 degrees Kelvin, somewhere around that temperature. But you have to build up enough shielding to totally put this thing into a huge shadow, so there's nothing, no place for the sunlight can't get at this thing, even though you're going to try to keep this thing in a position where the Earth is between it and the sun directly at most of the time. Is that how I understand this is going to be?
Yes, I'm going to make some guesses here, and then I'm going to turn it over to Paul for correction. You're always going to be aiming the thing at right. You've got a path between the spacecraft and the sun. You're always going to be aiming it at right angles to that path. So the telescope is aimed at right angles to that path toward the sun. The 5 layers of heat shield are on the sun side of you, and so therefore you're very restricted as to what objects you can look at during this month. As the Earth goes around the sun, and a month from now you can look at sky that have a 15 degree difference in declination, if you know what I mean. So you can rotate the spacecraft 360 degrees in azimuth, but you can only dip it a few degrees in elevation and still keep it in complete shadow. So if you want to measure a space object at some other declination, you have to wait until the spacecraft and the Earth going around the Sun during the once per year allow you to aim in some other direction. So you can see everything you want in the sky, but you can't see it all at once. You got to wait a full year to see everything. Is that approximately the way it works, Paul? Address 2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, they're looking away from the Sun all the time. So as the year goes on, you know, they'll be able to see what's on the other side. So, you know, if you're facing one of the signs of the zodiac, it's going to be a year before you get back and take another look at that same area. But as far as keeping the telescope itself shaded, originally when it first came out, people said, well, why don't you take this telescope and this shady thing and just have it have the shaded part facing the Sun all the time. Just go around the Earth. You can go up and service it just like the Hubble. But no, you can't do that because we drop it. So unlike the Hubble, it's an infrared telescope, and it doesn't want to see any heat, which means not only the Sun, it doesn't want to see heat from the Earth. It doesn't even want to see any reflection or heat from the Moon. The Moon and the Earth give off some amount of radiation, infrared radiation. So to do that, put it a million miles away, away, four times the distance of the Moon. Put a shade behind it because, you know, it's not going to be in the shade of the Earth. It's not like the Earth is going to create the shadow. It's not doing that. The protection is the Mylov sheet. But this thing is in, they call it a halo orbit. 500,000 mile diameter orbit. Picture a piece in space where the gravitational location is one spot. It actually orbits that one spot, let me drop it. And you know, it has an antenna pointing toward Earth on the shielded Sun side, but the telescope is on the shaded side all the time, so it will never see the heat from the Earth or the heat from the Moon. That's the whole idea of being out at L2. They sent other spacecraft out there. Herschel has been out there, by the European Space Agency. That was infrared. And they go out there for that reason. They don't want any air radiating off not only the Sun, but the Earth and the Moon. Back to you there, WS.
Paul, you and I have read some articles about, on the drawing board right now, got a repair robot that's eventually going to be going out there to various high-value spacecraft and catching up with them, latching on, and refueling, and maybe doing a small amount of repairs. Sure would be nice if somebody was planning a repair robot that's capable of going all the way out to L2, because no matter how well planned Hubble was, look at all the repairs we've done. No matter how well planned James Webb Space Telescope is, going to want to do some repairs of a gyro, a detector, a heat pump, something. However, a repair robot that can go to L2, that's a pretty healthy project. Has anybody even started talking about that yet, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, I remember about 5-6 years ago. So let's see, it had to be longer than that, because it was when the last Hubble service mission, that was, 2009. So probably in that time frame. When they did that last mission to Hubble, put in batteries and the computer and new optics and everything, whatever they did, it's really running good. I remember gyros are in there. There's six gyros. It's running like clockwork all these years, 2009. One of the things they did, they attached a docking collar to Hubble because they know in the future they're probably going to have to deorbit this thing. So this way they'll send some future spacecraft, and it's got a aircraft that view up at the Hubble and burn it up over the Pacific Ocean when we drop it. So the people that were designing this $8 billion James Webb Space Telescope back in that era, at the same time frame, they said, let's attach it, the same thing, and they did to the bottom of James Webb. There's no reason whatsoever for it, because present plans, even back then, even now, is not to send anything out to L2 to do a repair job. But, you know, it's one of these things, it's not going to cost that much. Let's attach to it and never know. You know, some people thought, well, maybe you could send a crew there. You know, we talked about that. Probably not. But if this type of equipment that's being developed by Lockheed now, it is a Restore L mission, they call it. It's going to go out and restore the that one satellite that's broken. If that type of thing works, we drop it. Which has the capability of refueling, cutting through insulation, and doing stuff, robotic arms and everything. You know, I could envision someday something docking with this thing and maybe being able to do something in the future to keep James Webb going. It's foresight, cheap install, and you never know, they might use it. Back to that WS one.
If the first repair robot is called the Restore L mission, what's the predicted date of that first launch, Paul? Go ahead.
So that was next year too, 2018. So I think that's sometime next year.
So this thing must be under construction if it's going to be launched in 1 year from now. Wow. I didn't think it was that soon. I thought it was a little bit longer than that. And will it have enough gas and repair missions and arm assemblies and whatever? Will it be able to repair more than one spacecraft, or is it right now only designed for one spacecraft? In which case, how do you refuel it? Over to you, Paul, KQLIW.
Well, I mean, the one that's up there needs to be refueled. What's the name of it? Is it? I forgot the name. It begins with an L. It'll come to me. But that's why they call it the Restore L mission. It's going to Lockheed mission, spacecraft. Lockheed 10. I don't know. But it, one of the things that they'll be able to do is with this robotic arm, cut a cap off that was never designed to be cut off. And install this valve setup where they'd be able to actually refuel it, and then with this new valve setup, it will be simpler in the future to actually refuel that spacecraft. Now the new spacecraft that are going out are starting to be designed like this, where they won't have to go through the step of actually cutting this piece off and reinstalling this, you know, this old ring setup thing with it that's going to call it a quick disconnect type of connection that's going to be hooked up. It won't need to cutting and installing part. It will already be there at launch on future satellites.
The Restore L mission designed to install a valve, replace the fuel, maybe do some other repairs of a particular existing spacecraft. After that, is the Restore L craft empty, or can it go fix somebody else? I mean, if it was a big enough tanker, I'd like to think it could fix three satellites, not just one. And after it has fixed those three satellites, what do you do next with that particular robot, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, well, this is a test mission, really. They want to see if this thing works. So they're only going to that one satellite, as far as I know. And remember, this satellite is going to, I think it's sort of 300 or 400 miles up. It's not geosynchronous. So that'll be the next step. Go out to geosynchronous. Then you can talk about reusability on the satellite, what they're going to do with that. But for now, they just want to see the ability of this thing. You know, it's got to be able to patch itself and do all this kind of work. Or restore a satellite. So that's it. I believe it's a Lockheed Mon project. I'll have to check.
pair of this one satellite then just sits there or comes back and burns up, what happens to the repair robot after it does its repair call? Has that been mentioned?
If it has, I haven't read it. I haven't read that much. You know, I've read a lot about it, but not that much. Whether it's for the future of it, we'll have to see. I'll look into it. But, you know, this will be the first of its kind to do something like this. I'm sure they'll get a lot better at it if this works. And then I could see what you said, having some future design of this setup going out to not only James Webb, maybe back to Hubble. Keep it going.
Yeah, if you can design a repair mission for any spacecraft at all, I'm reasonably sure you could design one to repair Hubble. And it sure would be nice if it had enough maneuvering fuel on the repair robot that it could, let's say, relink with the International Space Station. You refuel it and then decide who you're going to fix next. So the International Space Station could be a depot where you fill up your robots and keep sending them back out. And that could be maneuvering fuel, fuel for replacement on the spacecraft, parts replacement, gyros. Now, there's going to have to be some brains on board because of the delay time at the speed of light. When you're controlling the robot, depending on whether or not it's on the back side of the Earth from where you are and whatever, some of that communication is not real time. So just like we control Spirit, Opportunity, and I can't remember the name of the third one, Curiosity. Spirit, Opportunity, and Curiosity. It has to have a certain amount of brains on board because you're not talking to it real time. So does the robot have non-real time capability designed into it? I wonder if they've mentioned that yet, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, this one that's going to go up is supposed to have a lot of autonomous capability. Yes. And they work with the, you know, all these different gadgets they had attached to the space station sent up a couple of years ago. And they sent up this contraption that was attached to the space station and had all kinds of tools attached to it, and had a test bed that was attached to the space station. And this thing cracked open. You know, it's the same type of thing. It cut a cap off and installed some kind of a valve set up and actually put some kinds of fluid in. It wasn't hydrazine, but some kind of fluid that had the same consistency and of hydrazine. So they were able to put it into this tank and then actually seal it, and had the capability of cutting insulation. And it did some tests. Not even controlled by the astronauts. This was all controlled by Houston. That was all successful. In fact, it was just about a month or so ago, they disconnected the whole thing, put it into the back of Dragon, and sent it back to, actually they parked it up. It's part of the Dragon that we call the trunk. We drop it. Dragon does two things. When it disconnects from the space station, it brings back a lot of science and stuff inside the spacecraft itself, the pressurized part. But in the back, you have an open area to the vacuum of space, and it's called the trunk, and they bring up these large pieces of equipment. You might remember they bought a beam, and they attached beam to the International Space Station a little over a year ago. Still attached to it. The beam is the Bigelow expandable activity module that expanded, now attached to the space station. It's going to be there for another year. They'll deorbit that. But, you know, so it's bring up large things in the